Good morning, First E. How are you? This reminds me of 1958, the Newport Jazz Festival. I wasn't there. But my parents played the album almost every Sunday morning in my home, Mahalia Jackson's album. And in between two songs, the crowd was cheering and admonishing her, well, asking her to come and do more. And she got up to the mic and said, "You make me feel like I'm a star." And that's how you guys always make me feel. Thank you so much. Libby, thank you. Marcia, of course, Linda, and the entire First E family. Happy New Year. I haven't seen you folks since last year. Happy New Year. And happy Black History Month. Thank you for acknowledging the history of African Americans in our country. And I thought I'd start, before I get into my talk, I came across, how many of you are familiar with Derrick Bell? He wrote a book, Faces at the Bottom of the Well. I'm sorry? Oh, can you hear me? Okay, sorry. So how many of you are familiar with Derrick Bell? He wrote a book back in the early 90s, Faces at the Bottom of the Well. I think the subtitle is The Persistence of Racism or something like that. Anyway, I came across a review of his book. His wife is actually going to be speaking. The Southern Center for Human Rights invited his wife, his widow, to speak later this month. And so I was just kind of looking over some things about Professor Bell, who's deceased, and I came across this, a review of his book, and I thought it might be interesting to share with you all this morning. It kind of describes a little bit about the book. In Faces at the Bottom of the Well, civil rights activist and legal scholar Derrick Bell uses allegory and historical example to argue that racism is an integral and permanent part of American society. African American struggles for equality are doomed to fail so long as the majority of whites do not see their own well-being threatened by the status quo. Bell calls on African Americans to face up to this unhappy truth and abandon a misplaced faith in inevitable progress. So I just thought I'd share that with you as kind of a lead up to the talk today. So today's talk is titled, It's In There, Black Self-Actualization in the Face of Social Progress. Sounds pretty deep. And hopefully I will do what I set out to do. We'll see. And as always, I love to hear your thoughts with regard to what I write and what I share. Often, when in conversations with others about childhood or growing up, I find myself talking about four parents, two biological and two surrogate. I lived with and major decisions concerning my life were made by my biological parents, Simone and Anthony Sr. My paternal grandparents, on the other hand, Velma and Solomon Knight, provided important spiritual and cultural grounding for which I will be eternally grateful. My grandparents were simple people, raised in the Jim Crow South, South Georgia, and Central Florida specifically. They were born to parents who were sharecroppers, domestics, and workaday hustlers. They were the grandchildren of formerly enslaved blacks. In 1938, my grandparents left their five-year-old son, my father, in the care of his paternal grandparents and headed north to New York City, joining with the millions of other Southern blacks escaping the repression, violence, and terror of the Jim Crow South. My grandparents left behind loved ones, culture, and ancestral homes for the hope of a better life in the North. A North that often wanted their labor, but not them. This great migration, as it would come to be known, cast its net over the span of almost 60 years and blanketed this country from coast to coast with black and brown bodies and cultures and worldviews that would forever change the fabric of this country, much as slavery had done in the South some 300 years earlier. In New York City, my grandparents worked and hustled hard. My grandmother as a domestic, and my grandfather as a laborer and drugstore clerk. Many of the families for whom my grandmother worked were wealthy Jews. By working and sometimes living in their luxury apartments, she was exposed to the so-called finer things in life: furniture, crystal, china, antiques, all the exterior manifestations of wealth. She was also exposed to fine linens and clothes, undergarments and furs. In fact, she told me on more than one occasion that she would often try on the latter when the lady of the house was not around. I can just imagine my grandmother sauntering around a luxurious Park Avenue apartment, dressed in silk undergarments, fine clothes, and furs, owned by the woman for whom she worked, visualizing and mentally establishing her future. In 1952, her visualization exercises paid off. Just before making a trip south to introduce the family to her new adopted son, my grandmother played a number. She was a big numbers player. At one point, even the banker. When she returned to New York, she learned that she had hit the number and won $10,000. The equivalent today of almost $95,000. Years after my grandmother's death in 1994, my grandfather would often tell me the story of how he came home from work one day to their Harlem apartment to find money spread all over their bed. I can't begin to imagine the range of emotions my grandparents might have felt. Soon after the big win, my grandparents purchased a home on Long Island. They lived on the lower level and rented out the top floor. My grandfather continued to work blue-collar jobs and for additional income and health insurance. By the time of my birth in 1961, 9 years had passed since their financial windfall. During that time, my grandparents had built a beautiful new addition to their home. My grandmother had launched a successful real estate business, and she now owned many of the trappings of upper middle class living she had visualized years earlier working as a domestic. Their lifestyle had changed significantly, oddly, and it was the one into which I was born. The only one I knew they had until I was well into my adulthood. I had no idea of their abject poverty before that windfall. Just as my father had lived with his paternal grandparents while his mother and father established themselves in New York, I lived with my paternal grandparents the first 3 years of my life. My mom and dad would take me back on the weekends. As a little boy and even into adulthood, my grandmother often felt more like my real mother than my biological mother, a fact that would later become a source of irritation for my mother and a source of shame for me. I was my grandmother's first male grandchild and her favorite, a reality she never hid. Although looking back, I can now see that that may not have been the best thing to do. I adored my grandmother and worshiped the ground she walked on and did everything in my power to please her. Her home was a place of calm for me, unlike my parents' home where there were three other children oh, my siblings, and where my parents often quarreled and fought. By now, you probably can intuit the kind of relationship I had with my grandmother. Everyone knew how close we were. I could tell her anything, and we talked about everything. She was really my idol. During one of my stays with my grandmother, I was probably about 12 or 13, we were having one of our usual conversations. I don't recall what we were talking about, but I imagine the conversation had something to do with my schoolwork or maybe even my future. At one point during the conversation, my grandmother and I ended up in the kitchen. I was probably following her around as she was busy going about her housework. She retrieved something from the refrigerator. I'm sorry, she was retrieving something from the refrigerator when, in response to something I said, she closed the refrigerator door, looked me straight in the eyes, and pointed her index finger to my chest and said, "It's in there. Everything you need is in there." Now, I remember a lot of things about my grandmother, things she said, things she did, emotions she expressed, and some of her joys and pains. That moment, though, those words, and her voice saying them, those things are etched in my soul for all eternity. My ears heard her, but I would be well into my adulthood before my whole being would be able to register what she really was saying to me, before I would be able to hear her in earnest. Many more years would pass before I would be able to process what she said and put those words into practice, which I'm still working on. It's in there. Over the 40 plus years since my grandmother uttered those words, I've learned a lot, not only about myself, but also I've learned a lot about Black people, our history and our culture in this country. I've especially thought about my grandmother's words within the context of Black enslavement, Jim Crow, and the modern civil rights movement. As so much is made of the word progress, Blacks and whites use that word as a badge of honor. "We've come so far," I often hear folks say. "We've made so much progress," they boast. But for me, that word rings more hollow with each passing day. So I recently looked up the word progress. The Merriam-Webster Dictionary gives this definition: to develop to a higher, better, or more advanced stage. Hard for me to reconcile that definition with the lives, the lived realities of many Black people today. The familiar social markers we often use to determine a community's overall health, education, healthcare, employment, housing, financial stability, etc., are all about the same as they were during the civil rights movement. In some cases, they're even worse. So if progress means to develop to a higher, better, and more advanced stage, I'm not sure how we can define the state of the Black community as one that has progressed. But let's put that to the side for a moment. And back to my grandmother's assertion, it's in there. As human beings, we all come into this reality as intelligent creatures, fully equipped to live our unique, singular life. In her early 60s, my grandmother had learned that and was able to share that knowledge with me. But then I was not enslaved, nor had I been born in the South during the waning days of Jim Crow. And by the time my grandmother and I were having our conversation, the modern civil rights movement had ended, and Dr. King had been dead for about 5 years. By all accounts, the coast was clear. So my grandmother telling me that everything I needed for my life was in me made sense. I could travel on public transportation unimpeded, sit at lunch counters without incident, and try on clothes in department stores without police officers showing up. And I certainly didn't have to worry about being lynched. I wonder, though, who gave to generations of enslaved Africans and later African Americans the message my grandmother was able to give to me? Who reminded generations of blacks living in the Jim Crow South of their strength? And what pointed finger delivered to those who fought tirelessly for civil and human rights knowledge of the quintessential truth? It's in there. I'm grateful for my grandmother's wisdom, for having her voice, and those words, her words, as part of my life forever. They have sustained me at my lowest, and there have been some low points. It's in there. They have helped move me forward when I didn't believe I could continue on. It's in there. The truth, however, is that whether someone tells us it's in there or not, it is. That truth guides us always. It has no regard for progress or its absence. It's in there. It has no regard for joy or pain, tragedy or bliss. It's in there. And it has no regard for one's circumstance in life. It's in there. It's in there, as my grandmother said to me. Everything you or I will ever need, it's in there. Thank you.